Thank you, Joe. I guess this is what people probably who are outside of AA imagine that we look like on Halloween night. They probably think this is our norm. This is what they imagine when they go to an AA meeting. Anyway, I'm grateful to be here. I feel really blessed that I stayed sober long enough to be asked to do this. This stuff has changed my life, and I take this really seriously. People have been asking me what's more nerve-wracking, speaking at Central or being on the news, and this by far. And it's not just because you're real people looking back at me rather than a little black box, but it's because I take this so seriously and because I feel I have an obligation to carry the message here tonight. So. I thank Joe. You know, he did exactly what people were supposed to do when I first got here. He talked about me in the beginning, and he approached me after my first couple of meetings and talked to me out on the porch and made me feel welcome at Central. And Central, I owe a huge debt of gratitude to. Florida makes sense in my life today because of Central. I came here from New York City, and I thought I was the biggest deal in town. I didn't think that this city, this little rinky-dink Orlando, could handle all of my fabulousness. And, you know, alcohol humbled me. And I can see now that God brought me here for this experience, for this room, in fact. And I was sitting right on that wall where Robin is sitting, coming up on 2 years ago, and I heard a guy sitting on that wall, my first meeting, tell my story. And he talked about the pain of trying to deal with low self-esteem with the bottle. And that was my story. And I heard it the first night I came in here, and I kept coming back because I heard myself and you guys. So it means a lot to be here. My sobriety date is January 23rd of 2009. I showed up at Central when I was 26 years old. I've only been sober coming up on 2 years. So I have a little bit of insecurity about speaking up here because there's a lot of sobriety in the room. So it's like what the preacher says on Sunday morning. I used to hear he would say, he'd be all, if I say the right thing, remember it, and if I say the wrong thing, forget it quickly. So I'm going to make that, I'm going to make the preacher's disclaimer before I start. And I did make some notes just because I want to carry the message. Don't feel like I, you know, did it to be too much of a crutch. But my story is common. I was given everything. I had everything handed to me on a silver platter in life. White, affluent male in the richest country in the world. I went to private school from kindergarten through my master's degree. I got a car when I turned 16. I've never been out of a job. Neither have my parents. And yet, I think everybody in this room can relate to me because I lived for a lot of years in the misery and the despair that is alcoholism. And that is very real to me, and it crosses all kinds of boundaries. And it says in the big book, we're people who might not mingle otherwise. And I hope my story resonates a little bit. I just want to read one thing. If you guys want to leave early and go to the dance, page 73 in the big book is my story in two paragraphs. And I sometimes quote it in meetings because it means so much to me. More than most people, the alcoholic leads a double life. He is very much the actor. To the outside world, he presents his stage character. This is the one he likes his fellows to see. He wants to enjoy a certain reputation, but he knows in his heart he doesn't deserve it. The inconsistency is made worse by the things he does on his sprees. Coming to his senses, he is revolted at certain episodes he vaguely remembers. These memories are a nightmare. He trembles to think someone might have observed him. As fast as he can, he pushes these memories far inside of himself. He hopes they will never see the light of day. He is under constant fear and tension that makes for more drinking. And that's what it was like for me. I'm going to try and do the well-established what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And what it was like was pretty simple early on. I was reflecting on this a lot. All I ever wanted to be was perfect. Simple enough request, and a pretty alcoholic one at that. I was born in San Antonio, Texas, into a good family. I was born to the type of people that, when you say good people, you're talking about my grandparents. I had two grandfathers who established law firms in San Antonio. And my parents followed in good footsteps. You know, I had parents who were both born and raised in San Antonio. They went to very good colleges. They met in law school in San Antonio. And I don't know that they were such a great personality match, but for whatever reasons, there was a merger. They went for it, and they decided that they were right for each other. And in 1980, they'd been married about 2 years, came my older sister, Carrie. Beautiful baby, blonde hair, blue eyes. And for about a year, I think my parents had the life they expected. And a little singing, that's fine. For about a year, my parents had the life they expected. And when Carrie was 1 year old, they noticed some things that weren't matching up, that just weren't right about Carrie. She hadn't really started talking. Her motor skills were off, and the left side of her face seemed to be not developing in the same way that the right side of her face was developing. They noticed this gradually, obviously, and took Carrie to a doctor eventually when things were, when the time was right, and Carrie was diagnosed with terminal brain cancer at 1 year old. This was before I was even there. And so, you know, thinking about it today, my parents, when they're getting this diagnosis on Carrie, are the age that I am right now, were the age that I am right now. And I can't imagine hearing that about your child. No parent expects to get dealt that card in life. And it's so rare that it's reasonable not to expect it. But my parents had done everything right. And they ended up with Carrie on their hands. One of my earliest memories, I was in the kitchen of our old house, this small little house, and early in the morning, I was getting dressed in the kitchen for some reason. I don't know what was going on, but I was in the kitchen. Dad was hustling me up to get dressed, and the other person there was this woman, Khaki, my nanny. And she was taking over pretty much, finishing up getting me dressed for preschool, because Dad was racing out of the house. Mom had spent the night with Carrie at the hospital. Dad was going to go there. They essentially worked in shifts because Carrie was in the hospital constantly, chemotherapy, radiation, etc. So as a young kid, the parents weren't at home a lot. This woman, Khaki, was sort of my mom. I guess she left. I don't really know. All I know is she was there when I woke up, and she was there when I went to bed. She put me to bed. So Mom and Dad and Carrie were at the hospital and at work and not really at home. And that's what life was like when I was very, very young. 1985, my sister Jenny comes along. And by this point, Carrie is become kind of a medical miracle. The cancer was terminal, but especially at that age, they were never expecting her to leave the hospital. But by the time Jenny came along in 1985, so Carrie's about five, I'm a year and a half, it's probably 1986, Carrie comes home and is living with us, full on medical conditions at home. The house has to be sort of like a hospital. And that's how my mom wanted it. She didn't want her daughter shipped off anywhere. So now it's me, Jenny, Carrie at home, parents a little bit more regularly in the picture, but we have this sister who requires hospital-like care. I mean, Carrie can't eat, stomach tube that she'd, sometimes she'd yank her stomach tube out, she'd come wandering around the house in her, you know, wobbly little walk, and she'd have food pouring out all over the floor. I have to make light of it. She couldn't take herself to the bathroom, couldn't get herself dressed, bathed, anything like that. And what came to be one of the most traumatic elements of it for me as a kid was her seizures. Carrie would have these huge seizures. And they happened often enough to where they weren't a big deal for us. But here I was, an insecure kid, now in grade school. And trying to be normal, you know. And I have this distinct memory of being at the grocery store. That's one thing that Carrie liked to do, was go to the grocery store. If she stood behind the cart, she could kind of get enough support to wobble through there. And of course, we're in the checkout line at the front of the grocery store where everybody's standing around just waiting. And Carrie and this girl, of course, that I know from church, is like there with her mom about two lines over. So here I am, insecure kid, and Carrie has one of her seizures. And these seizures are like, fall down on the floor, shaking violently. People think she's dying in front of their eyes. And this type of stuff happened all the time. The family life was not normal. And, you know, that stuff impacted me tremendously. From when I was a very young kid, I had sort of the dominant theme of my childhood, adolescence, and really 20s establish, and it was the normal sibling of a severely handicapped kid. Carrie was the oldest, but I was number two, so I was effectively the oldest. Also had a little brother, Warren, and that theme just dominated my childhood days. And early memories of alcohol, my parents were daily drinkers, absolute daily drinkers. My father always more than my mother, but it was consistent. I think to this day, I'm quite sure my father couldn't tell you the last time he didn't have a drink. That's what I grew up in. That's what was normal to me. I remember getting a little tiff. I was obstinate kid, as a lot of us were. We were on a road trip. We couldn't fly with Carrie, so we took road trips, and I think I was smart enough to know that I was going to be pushing my dad's buttons when I said this, but I told him I wanted something to go in the cooler in the car. I had a drink that I wanted to stay cool, and I said, I want to put this in the cooler, the little igloo thing. And I was told that there wasn't room in the igloo because the igloo was full of beer, and Mom and Dad needed to have cold beer for when we rolled up in the motel that night, however far we were driving that day. And so my drink couldn't go in, and I remember very distinctly thinking, that stuff's not for me. That pissed me off, you know. I wanted my little Capri Sun in there in that cooler, and Dad said there wasn't room for it. And I thought, that stuff's not for me. I don't like that beer stuff. I progressed the family a little bit. I have a little brother as well, so now there are four kids of us. And in 1990, Mom is elected as a county judge in Bexar County, Texas. It's a position she still has to this day, 20 years later. The Spencer house was like walking on eggshells. We had Carrie, who demanded full attention. We had my parents, both in significant careers. We had my father worrying about money and living in his own stuff. And there was a tremendous amount of arguing. My parents argued publicly, loudly, in the house a lot. I longed for those families where the parents would argue behind closed doors and the kids would never know about it. That was not my experience. I would try and referee a little bit, but that generally got me in more trouble. So you have all of this dynamic, and I just remember the house felt like I had to hold my breath all the time. And what this was teaching me as a little kid is the following. I got the message loud and clear that there was no energy, no space for me to mess up. There was There wasn't room for that in our family dynamic. I got the message very clearly that I had to take care of myself, and really they needed me to be perfect. They needed me to take care of myself and not need anything from them. And I very consciously, by about 6th or 7th grade, had this idea in my head. I wanted to be the best little boy in the world. I took it to heart. I said, if this is the dynamic I'm placed in, I'm going to do it. And that streak started when I was young, you know. I wanted it, and it wasn't just grade-wise either. I wanted the best grades, but I wanted to have the most friends, and I wanted to be good at sports. I wanted to be so perfect that compared to Carrie, nobody could say anything. It was that bit of compensation that we had. And in the grade school especially, it worked pretty well. I was never very good at sports, but the other stuff I pulled off. I had friends. I made very good grades. I was a dork. But I was a dork who compensated. And I compensated on the social side of things, and I worked hard to be kind of cool. Through it all, I have to mention, you know, we have this whole family at home dynamic. I had this grandmother, my mom's mom, who I talked about being from good people, and she was the best of the best. And I remember being in her backyard one day watering this big fern she had hanging back there, and I said to her, "Who's your best friend?" And she said, "Well, I guess it was your grandfather. But he was dead before I was born." And she said, "But now that he's gone, I guess it's you." And I said, "Well, you're my best friend too." And that sounds corny. It sounds like a movie line, but it's a direct quote, and I remember it. And we lived that way. This woman was my best friend and the mother figure that I didn't really have at home. I get to high school. I had a full academic scholarship to this little private school. And that theme of wanting it all continued. I pressed on the grades, and I did pretty well in school. But I also wanted to be popular. And you know what popular kids do in high school? They go to parties. And that was where I took my first drink. I remember the girl's house. I was at Maya Gill's house. I was 16 years old because I could drive myself there. And I wouldn't say, I don't know if I would say I became alcoholic after the first drink, but I know this. I never could again have fun without drinking. People might want to go to the theme park, spend a day doing that stuff. I'd go, but I wanted to drink while we were there. That's how it became for me after the first drink. I didn't have fun sober after that. I got into a good college, and I went away, far away from home. And you come from that kind of the feelings that I had, a loving family, but a family that was so tense. College was a point of liberation for me, but it was classic case. I took it very far. My freshman year, the alcohol was everywhere, and I took to it. I remember being sick all of freshman year because I never got enough sleep, but it was sophomore year when I was 19, my second year there, far away from home, which I liked, in over my head. You know, I was at school with people, these kids were like, they grew up in New York City, they went to these fancy schools, they knew what they were doing, and that feeling of just missing the instruction book on how to do all of this stuff came on me really hard, really hard. I was cool enough that I was allowed to live in this room called the Zoo at Princeton. And so the Zoo, you can imagine, it was a 10-man suite, lots of parties. I have a couple of distinct memories about the alcoholism already at 19. And first is September 11th. This was the year 2001. We had had some epic party in our room the night before. I don't know who, you know, we let people who didn't even live in the room have parties in our room. And September 10th, I had stayed up all night, and I remember being awakened after about an hour of sleep to the drama that was unfolding that day. And I was still drunk and partied up. And I remember experiencing this national tragedy in a very alcoholic way. All I could think about was how this was going to delay, how this was going to impede on my next drink and my next party. And that's how I experienced our national tragedy. I remember one other thing that kind of highlights where I was going with my alcoholism that year. I was editor of the newspaper at my school, and I was there working on a Sunday afternoon, because you have to work on Sunday for the Monday paper. And I had had one of those epic, insane nights, just like page 73 in the big book, where you're under constant fear and tension, you drink more, and then you have the regrets from the night before to pile on top of it all. I was having just the Category 5 hangover that we have, and trying to get this work done, because we had to put the paper out the next day. And, you know, I had stolen a bottle of whiskey from the party that was in our room the night before, and it was sitting in my dorm room. So here I am nursing this terrible hangover, sitting at the damn paper, not wanting to be there, trying to work, in that million miles an hour going in my head, hating myself, hating my life. And for the first time it occurred to me I could go back to my room, get absolutely hammered by myself, and I'd be okay. I had that bottle of whiskey, and the moment I decided I was going to drink, it was still across campus and still a couple hours away because I had to finish this stupid newspaper. The moment I knew I was going to go back to my room and get hammered by myself on that whiskey, I was fine. I made the decision and I was fine. I got the work done and I did it. And that gave me the relief I needed. The rest of college was pretty much a disaster. You know, it talks in the big book about stepping on the toes of our fellows and they will retaliate. I stepped on a lot of toes. I was retaliated against. As with all of us, there's more drama than I should need to get into right now, and I'm trying to move it along. But one of the most devastating things for me with this, I still have this ideal of perfection for myself, and that included being popular. I more than anything in the world wanted to get into this club called the Ivy Club at Princeton. And it was the most exclusive, of course, that's what I wanted. And it was, in my thinking, the best there. I had burned so many bridges, though, in my first 2 years at Princeton. I was rejected from that club twice. And more or less after that, threw in the towel on the whole experience. I could barely be bothered to show up to class. I got a lot more into the drinking by myself. I did the 10-man suite, and then the last 2 years I lived alone. So kind of shows you the extreme that I was going to. And I left that school with deep regret. I had had a tremendous opportunity handed to me, and I left with very few friends and terrible grades. And I felt really guilty about that. Somehow I did get into a good graduate school in New York, and that was my next step. And you know, in the big book it talks about sometimes we feel like we're regaining control. And for 1 year, my first year in New York City, I thought things were changing. I was so busy. I was going to grad school full-time, and then I was working on the weekends. I had binges, you know, but it wasn't the consistent all-the-time drinking. And I wondered if I was getting better. You know, I wondered if I was maturing or growing out of it. I was not. After grad school, I got a job in New York, and it was my first news reporting job, a first kind of real job. And I thought the city was my oyster. I thought I was a big deal. Not to mention I worked at this crappy little cable station that probably had 100 people watching it, but it didn't stop me from thinking I was a big deal. And I partied like I was a big deal. I was increasingly hanging out with trashier and trashier people. My experience includes dry goods sometimes. And it's mentioned in the big book, so I'm going to mention it briefly here. I came to love cocaine because I thought it made me a better alcoholic. I was so concerned about what people thought about me and the chaos that ensued when I drank like I like to drink, I perceived that when I took cocaine, I was more in control of myself. That brought me a whole new level of friends. And so my life was working at this raggedy job that I thought was a big deal, drinking every single night and drugging. And on the nights when I couldn't do it, when I couldn't bear the world, I would come home and I would take sleeping pills. That was kind of my cycle. It was either hide with the sleep and just go that way, or do the party route. This was a time in my life when suicide felt a very real option. I had to pass every day as I was driving this one part on the Belt Parkway in Brooklyn, which goes all the way, Angel, all the way around the edge of Brooklyn. And there's this one curve that I found myself passing almost every day. And I thought, every time I passed it, I thought, what would happen if I just did this? You know, if I just went into that water. And this was a daily thing that I lived with because of that alcoholic pain. And got one more New York story before I kind of try and move on to the other stuff. But this is it. You know, I began to think I was losing my mind. I had this dream one morning. I had a big night the night before, and I wake up to these voices, my damn neighbors, arguing in the hallway of our apartment building and screaming at each other. And I go out there and look in my hallway, and there's nobody in the hallway, and then I hear the voices downstairs. The argument was actually down in the lobby. So here I am in my boxers, and it's, you know, I think it's in March or late in mid-March, and I'm down in the lobby, and these idiots, they knew that I was coming after them, and so they run out onto the street to avoid me. And so I run in my little boxers, barely out of bed, hungover as all hell, out into the street to give these people a piece of my mind and tell them you cannot be waking people up in an apartment building in New York City with your petty fighting in the halls. I get outside, and they're not there. And it becomes immediately clear to me that this was all a kind of a weird dream, that they had actually had that argument, and I had heard it, but it was about a week earlier, and it wasn't happening then. And it was just replaying in my little dream, and there I am in my damn boxers in New York City, and I lucked out. I got to wrap this up, and I can't believe I'm in this position. I come down to Florida unexpectedly. I never thought I'd come to this state, but New York was increasingly unsustainable. And for the first 4 months, I had another one of those periods where it wasn't bad. But it got very bad again. And this is sort of the period that I talk about what happened. October 23rd of 2008, I get a call at work from my sister that my grandmother had gone into the hospital, had a huge stroke. And next flight home the following morning, and she was dead before I could get to San Antonio. And that trip home to Texas was going to be the beginning of the end for me. And I didn't know it. You know, I bizarrely stayed at my dead grandmother's house when I was there for her funeral, and found myself just in her kitchen in the middle of the night drinking her old whiskey, crying into her bathrobe. It was a pathetic scene. I was devastated. This was a mother to me. And I came back to Florida, tried to keep going, but the drinking got to the point where it was in the mornings. I was drinking before I would go to work. And the drinking wasn't working. I remember being at a Lake Eola bar and just the vodka seemed like it wasn't having an effect anymore. It might as well have been water. And I remember sitting down in the parking lot of my work, which is not that far from here, and I was certain that my future had two possibilities. I was going to die from the drinking and drugging, or if I stopped, they were going to have to put me on so much medicine to calm this crazy mind, I was going to be essentially a different type of death, you know, an insane asylum kind of existence. And that was my future, and that terrified me, you know. It didn't stop me from drinking a little bit more. My last weekend was not anything that unusual. It was not any more abysmal than many of the weekends that had preceded it, but I'd finally had enough. I woke up one morning to crawl across a bedroom full of broken glass because I had to break into my apartment the night before because I'd been out drinking and I locked my keys inside. So I wake up and that, you know, it wouldn't have been, it was not that unusual, that type of stuff. But I get in the shower with this obscene hangover. My parents happen to be in town this weekend, so they want me up earlier than I want to be up. And I just have, you know, nearly cut my foot on this glass that's all over my floor. And I just start screaming at the top of my lungs. I'm screaming in the shower. I'm such a fucking alcoholic. I'm such a fucking alcoholic. I'm such a fucking alcoholic. Screaming. And only you guys will understand that 3 hours later, at lunch, I took my next drink. You know, that kind of despair, and I continued. But I had made the decision to come to AA, and I did it that Friday night. That was a Saturday morning, and I waited without drinking. I don't know why Friday night seemed like the perfect AA night to me, but I did it. And I sat right back in here, and I did what I was asked because I didn't know what else to do. I did the 90 meetings in 90 days. My sponsor, the person who would become my sponsor, came up to me and more or less told me he was going to be my sponsor. He said, "Do you have a sponsor?" I said, "No. I'm available for sponsorship." And I stood there like, what does he want me to say that? And anyway, I figured out that he wanted me to say, "Will you be my sponsor?" And I did it. And I followed his directions because I was so sick of that misery that I had. I didn't have any trouble admitting my alcoholism. I did all of the steps in order with him. And I think more than anything, they're important in their own right, but they also made me feel a part of an AA. I felt like I was doing what I needed to be in the middle of this group, which is something that I heard that I wanted. I was sick and tired of the stuff that I had been living in. And what it's like now is completely different. That's all I can say. I mean, if you're a real alcoholic, sobriety is totally different. There's no other way to say it. It's not kind of just like your life was before, but without drinking. That's not been my experience. I've been experiencing a totally different type of life than I had before. And today my goal is long-term sobriety. And I try and say that out loud even though it scares the crap out of me. Because I'm just like you guys. I don't know if I can stay sober forever. But what I love and what I hear in here, and it's not just our slogan, is a day at a time. And that has been the most important thing in my recovery today. I used to think that people who had 20 years of sobriety would say that and it was just automatic. Like, you stay sober that long and it just kind of happens. I think I get more and more the fact that it is a daily deal for us. And we have to be rigorous about maintaining this sobriety if we want to keep it. I think if you're in here tonight, we don't have to be. There are a lot of people who are reliving. They're thinking Halloween is going to be their chance to prove that they're not alcoholic. They're reliving that insanity right now, getting dressed up in their apartments, going to parties, whatever. I'm grateful I don't have to be a part of that today. I have some basic things that I do in here now that I think help keep me sober. I try to go to 5 meetings a week. I normally make 4 or 3. But I try, and I try to be rigorous about it. I think I can honestly tell you that sobriety is my priority today. I take this stuff seriously because I know I can drink again. And I really don't want to go back to the life that I had before. My thinking was always my biggest problem, I believe. I couldn't handle alcohol, but my thinking certainly gave me a lot of trouble. What I have learned in these rooms is something I tell my sponsees all the time, and people are probably tired of hearing it from me, but I've learned not to believe everything I think, because I believed all the crap that was in my head for a long time, and I kept getting drunk over it. I had these distorted realities that were not true anywhere else except up in here, but up in here is enough to get me drunk, because I can't live with the self-loathing, the chaos that I create in my mind. And I have to be really rigorous about it. You know, I'm in a way embarrassed to say it, but I know that it happens to other people too. This week, you know, I had an experience where I was completely unsatisfied. I, you know, got into the cycle of, I'm not good enough, my job's not good enough, I'll never get a new job, wherever it goes, and I let myself follow it for a little while. But today, when that happens, I know to not believe it. You know, I used to take it as truth. And that stuff is my disease trying to get me drunk again. And it worked for a lot of times, and I'm glad AA has taught me that I don't have to believe all that crap anymore. The last thing I feel like I got to be grateful to AA about tonight is I mentioned that handbook of life that so many of us feel like we never got. I feel like I come to meetings here and I get sort of an additional page each time I come. There are basic things in here that a lot of people learned from their parents, from grade school, that all of us seem to be sick on that day. And stuff like, quit trying to outthink your common sense. And if I don't step on the toes of my fellows, they're probably not going to step on mine. And if I help other people are likely to help me. When I pay my bills, I have more money. You know, if I only worry about what's inside George's hula hoop, I don't have as much drama in my life. You know, I'm far from perfect. I still struggle with a lot of things. Here I am, 28 years old. I have never been in a serious relationship my entire life. I know a lot of that has to do with the alcoholism, but I'm kind of like, you know, what's happening to me? But I'm so grateful that a day at a time I seem to be getting better. I'm going to close with two quick thoughts. This summer I was blessed to be able to go to the AA International Convention, and it happened to be in my hometown. It was in San Antonio. And I'm reading, this is going to be a quote, because this one lady from New York spoke, and she so moved me, and she ended her talk with these thoughts about living, just basic living, and how she was going about it and doing it successfully and soberly. She said, start where you are, do what you can gracefully, step out in faith, and expect God to help. I mean, that sounds like a formula to me when I can apply it. I had made a commitment in my second year of sobriety to run a half marathon, which I don't know if that's, I don't know what that is, but I'm doing it with my dad in 2 weeks, and I had been home, I was home last weekend for something separate. I'd gone running with him. My dad was always my harshest critic, you know. I didn't get to touch on him too much, but we did about, I think, an 8-mile practice, and he's in very good shape. He's like better shape than I am, and he's my dad. And you know, he said to me, as he was taking me to the airport last weekend, he said, "You seem to be doing really well." And I said to him, you know, you mean physically, like you think I'm going to do well in the race? And he said, no, you seem to be doing really well. And that is a gift of the program. He meant in general. He meant George seemed to be doing well. And I was never doing well before I came to AA. The stuff has changed my life, and I hope that the people in here tonight heard something that helped them stay sober, because this stuff means the world to me.